Well, the world is a dumpster fire, and nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right, and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, we have got author, musician, Heather Hutchison. This is an amazing conversation. I'm going to tell you right up front that you need to go get her book, Holding On by Letting Go. It is an incredible memoir full of insights and ups and downs. It's a real masterwork in storytelling as far as telling a true story. I cannot recommend it enough. Get the audiobook. She reads it. It's excellent. She also has an album out, Where the Ocean Meets the Sand, and you'll hear that she's a very gifted musician as well. And we're going to get into all of that in just a couple of minutes, but I need to address a couple of things right up top. Last week was a very oversharey kind of week for me. How was it for you? It's been an interesting week for me because last Friday in my introduction, I just about broke down because I'm in the middle of pretty hairy bipolar episode, depression, and I'm not managing it super well. In fact, I was unshowered, unshaved, disheveled, and I showed up. And that was the lesson that we took from it overall, was it's better to show up a little funky than to not show up at all. That's my opinion. It's still my opinion. And I'm still going through a depression, but it's been a little better lately. I'm able to put my head above the clouds every now and again, like right now, today, as a matter of fact, I'm feeling pretty excited because this conversation that I had with today's guest, Heather Hutchison, was really something that I needed, quite a lot. But what else happened? Well, I'm going to tell you. On my personal Facebook page and my Instagram on Indigenous Peoples Day, which also happens to coincide with National Coming Out Day, I made it known publicly for the first time that I'm a bisexual man. And there's a lot of reasons why I was hesitant to talk about that. A lot of reasons. For one, I pass. I've been twice married, almost three times, to women. I've never really publicly been in a relationship with a man, privately, but that's a whole other bucket of syrup. And I pass. I got kids. I'm a married dude. I present as straight. In fact, I present as just about whatever you'd like me to. Don't I? I wear clothing that doesn't have logos on it. I have generally conservative haircuts. You'd never know by looking at me what my politics are, what kind of music I listen to, what my thoughts on just about anything are. And so it's pretty easy to project just about anything onto the blank canvas that I put out to the world. So why would I put that out there, especially when I grew up in a world where bisexual chicks are hot and bisexual dudes are fags that need to be killed? That's what I grew up with. That my own friends had these kind of thoughts. So why now? I mean, it's relatively safe for me. I mean, I could have just stayed hidden for sure. Why wouldn't I? I'm 45 years old, but I mean, it kind of occurred to me that there are a lot of people in my life who I've watched come forward with a truth that was going to make their life more difficult. And I found it to be very brave, but secretly also felt that's very scary. I could never do that. But here I am doing that exact thing. And I'm honestly still coming to terms with a lot of things. I'm realizing that the reason I hadn't talked about it publicly before is probably in large part due to the fact that I've had so much conditioning to let me know that it's something I should be quiet about, to let me know that it makes me less than in a lot of people's eyes. And quite frankly, in the LGBTQIA plus community, the B is pretty disliked from what I can see. People talk a lot of smack about bisexual people. It's kind of bizarre. That's another B. I don't quite understand it. I don't get it, but it definitely made me feel like this is something I should be quiet about because there's no love anywhere for bisexual men. There's no love. It's something that nobody wants. Nobody wants to see that. Nobody wants to hear that. And maybe that's why I think it's important for me to say something now. Because I have always sort of considered it a part of my identity as a human being, but I've considered it a part of my identity that I wasn't comfortable presenting out of fear, out of danger. Now, you want to talk about brave? Because I do. Let's talk to Heather Hutchison. This is an awesome conversation, and I cannot wait for you to read her book, Holding On by Letting Go, a memoir, and Where the Ocean Meets the Sand. She's recording a new album in the studio as we speak. Ladies and gentlemen, enjoy the great Heather Hutchison. Heather, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. I'm going to start us in kind of a weird place.
Okay.
I just finished your book.
Oh, did you? Oh, awesome. Thank
minutes
you.
Ago.
Wow.
because I couldn't put it down.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
And that's a little unusual for me to power through something like that, because I got it yesterday.
Oh, holy crap.
yeah. And honestly, it spoke to me in a way that no other piece of writing has.
Oh, wow.
As far as your story, I felt such a kinship with you on so many levels. And so I might even be just a little overwhelmed at the moment because the book ends in a place that is pretty fresh.
Yes.
I mean, probably not even completely healed over.
No, exactly.
So let's try to jump right in. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. So I'm a singer, songwriter, and author. I have 3 albums out so far. I'm actually working on another one like today as we speak. So that's pretty exciting. And I just released my memoir, Holding On by Letting Go, which kind of chronicles my life as a blind person in Canada and Latin America, and kind of on the same vein, along the same vein, kind of this alternative theme of my mental health struggles over the years, which culminated in me being hospitalized for psychiatric care during the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic.
And that's crazy.
Yeah, it was.
That is so much. There are about a million things in the book that really struck me that I was completely unaware of. And we're going to jump around all over the place.
Cool.
And so I think that people will definitely want to get the book, definitely check it out. It's a must read for absolutely anyone. And the music is great too. I checked out the music days ago because I'm a musician myself. So I always like to check out musical artists. I love to have music people on the show because there's a dialogue mm-hmm. that music people have that other people don't, I think.
I agree. So, it's true.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. So one of the stories that really popped out at me, because having been friends with, what we would call disabled people throughout most of my teenage years, I would hear things all the time about, you know, people trying to help mm-hmm. in sort of condescending ways mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And it kind of taught me not to do that,
yeah.
You know, because it's sort of an instinct, I guess, that, you know, we're taught, oh, we're the default. And so, you know, anybody who, like you mentioned, sighted people versus blind people, or even, you know, partially sighted mm-hmm. people. And sighted people don't think of themselves as sighted people. They think of themselves as people.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a very weird thing that isn't discussed very much. But one of the things that really struck me was you were talking about it being at a curb, at a crosswalk, and two guys standing next to you and telling you it was okay to go. Mm-hmm. And then a bus went by.
Yes.
That is shocking.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet kind of not surprising if you've dealt with humanity.
Exactly. Yeah, I think I said in the book, luckily I had little enough faith in humanity to not pay attention.
You said something in the opening of the book that grabbed me right away, and it was, I believe you said, I'm not sure when the idea occurred to me that life was optional. Mm-hmm. And that really hit the nail on the head for me. I grew up kind of in a similar fashion. I was a little kid when I discovered my fun suicidal ideation. And it's kind of stayed with me mm-hmm. pretty much my whole life. And there are a lot of things about it that I find funny now. There's like dark humor
totally.
Involved
yes.
in all of that. And I imagine you've got some moments as well. Mm-hmm. There were some moments in the book that were pretty hilarious. I mean, that story, it's dark,
yeah,
for sure. But let's try and put this in some kind of an order, because I'm just fangirling out at you right now. And so let's do this. So you said that you grew up in Canada,
yes.
Specifically in the Vancouver area.
I actually grew up in Edmonton and then moved to Vancouver.
Okay.
If you know where
okay.
that is.
Yeah. Actually, as a matter of fact, I'm kind of looking at Vancouver right now.
Oh, really?
As a possible relocation.
Oh,
yeah.
It's awesome. I love Vancouver. You totally should.
So tell me a little bit about growing up in Edmonton. What was your life like?
It was actually pretty quote unquote normal to a certain point. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, those early years were kind of, you know, self-involved, right? We don't really look at ourselves in relation to the rest of the world. We just are, kind of. And so, yeah, like I would hang out with my brother and my cousins and I did everything they did. Nobody ever really said anything otherwise until really around the time I started school, like so probably kindergarten, grade one. And then you probably read in the book that story about the bully on the playground who actually made me realize, like, holy crap, I am different and this is forever, because he asked me why I couldn't look or why I didn't look at anything. And I just kind of really matter-of-factly said, oh, I'm blind. Like you say, oh, I have brown hair and blue eyes, whatever.
Right.
And he turned on me like so suddenly and pushed me backwards and yelled, you know, something mean about me being blind and got on his bike and left. And it was just such a startling reaction. And I would say that was kind of like the beginning. From that point on, I kind of paid attention to how people reacted to me and started realizing, yeah, a lot of people are kind of weird around me.
That has to be a strange thing to deal with, because it would be, I mean, it's like you said, it would be like someone suddenly discovering their eye color was something that could get them hurt.
Yeah.
That's got to be informing all of your relationship dynamics moving forward. Mm-hmm. Once you know that the world is capable of violence for something that means something very different to you than it does to them.
Yes.
Are there things that you encounter on a pretty regular basis still?
Yeah, for sure. Probably not. Well, obviously not the playground bully variety, but
right.
Yeah, like people come up to me, you know, when I'm out buying groceries and just be like, oh, what's it like to be blind? And it's like, well, what's it like to be sighted? Like, how do you possibly answer that question as you're standing in front of the apples in Safeway or whatever? Yeah. Like, is impossible. Or people come up to the people I'm with and be like, oh, you're such a saint for taking care of her and stuff like that. And it's, yeah, so it's a challenge. It's challenging for you know, my loved ones as well, because they are exposed to it as well.
Well, and because it's not your job you're not on this earth to teach people about blindness.
Yes, exactly. And I think people forget that, and you know, that we're just regular people. And sometimes we just want to buy our groceries and go home. Or like when I was in university, right. I'd be studying on the bus and people would, you know, interrupt my studying, cramming for this exam that I had to take in an hour or whatever. And like, want to know about my life as a blind person. And I'm like, I have to take this, like, I'm living a life here. I'm not here to, you know, inspire you. Or I don't know if you've heard of like inspiration porn.
Yes.
So that sort of thing. Or, you know, like, I'm just trying to live my life the same as anybody else. And I don't want to be, you know, I think these interviews and the book and stuff like that are awesome opportunities to educate people, but I don't want to be on 24/7.
Right, exactly. You know, that's a thing. I mean, if anybody met me out in public and they would want to talk to me like I'm their therapist,
yeah,
it's, you know, like let's not go there. For one, I am not a licensed therapist. I'm your buddy. I'm just you know, I'm a golden retriever. that's it. Like, anything you get out of the conversation with me is probably something you already had in you. But I want to talk to you about something else. I want to actually get into the music a little bit. Tell me a little bit about how you got into music.
Yeah, so I actually started piano when I was 5, and I was like a super terrible music student. Like, my piano teacher hated me because I didn't want to play like anything that was in my books. I just wanted to like learn songs on the piano, and I was, you know, already kind of making up my own like stupid songs or whatever. And so I actually quit piano after not too long. But then I, you know, got to my teen years and that isolation started to be more prominent, and I started sitting back down at the piano and started composing my own songs and actually went back to piano lessons so I could learn to accompany myself more efficiently, I guess. So yeah, it was kind of this, like, I would sit down at the piano and I would write about how I was feeling, and then the feelings actually made more sense. So I wrote a couple songs, then I went into a music competition that was for our region, and in the finals I actually met a producer backstage. He was on the panel of judges for the competition, and he was like, oh, you know, I liked the song you sang, we should talk about doing some recording. And I, you know, cool, but I wasn't gonna let myself believe that it was gonna actually happen. And then, you know, 3 weeks later we were in the studio recording. So it was like so crazy to go from like the high school band room to the recording studio in like 3 weeks.
Yeah, because that's a very different environment.
Yes. Yeah, I knew nothing, so yeah.
Yeah, well, and it sounds like people were pretty patient with you as you kind of figured it out, or were you in there just sort of like, no, yeah, I know, I know, cool, it's cool.
Yeah, no, whatever. They were so awesome, and it was, you know, I had a lot to learn, but it was also kind of like coming home, like finding this place in the world that was safe, and people just treated me like me, like even like all these, you know, seasoned professional session players would just come in and they just treat me like a girl who liked music. Like they weren't weird or anything. And so, yeah. Like it was just, yeah, I had a lot to learn about the ins and outs of the studio and, you know, the lingo, how that all worked. But it, at the same time, it felt like I'd never really been anywhere else.
Yeah. And learning to play with other musicians versus playing by yourself, the collaborative skill that it takes. Yeah. That's a whole other thing. And you had to learn that pretty quickly.
Yes. It was very fast.
So tell me a little bit about how that's had an impact on your mental health as far as music goes. I mean, what does it offer you? Because it can be a number of things. I mean, there's a lot of people have this idea that all creativity comes from suffering, mm-hmm. of some kind.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's true. I think that suffering can lend itself to a creative person finding something to do with that suffering.
Yeah.
But it's usually something more along the lines of a skill you develop and a muscle you learn how to flex, mm-hmm. To be able to get your thoughts and ideas across. What has that been for you?
Yeah, so it's always been such an outlet. It's always been a way for me to connect with people as well, because, you know, as I'm struggling as a teenager, my first album came out when I was 16, and I would be playing these shows and people would come up to me and be like, you know, this song really spoke to me because this happened to me. And so it's just that human connection, I guess, that was, so like I would be figuring out how I was feeling in the songs, and then I would be getting this human connection of like, oh, hey, like I'm not alone. Other people are feeling this way too. But I would say, like, yeah, you talk about creativity and suffering. When I'm at my worst, I'm not playing music. Like people are like, oh, you're probably like writing so many songs. I'm like, no, like I'm just trying to make it through the next 5 minutes. I'm not writing songs. Like at the beginning of the pandemic, a lot of people, like a lot of my friends and colleagues were, mm-hmm. they'd do these like Facebook lives or whatever and like share these new songs of like hope and inspiration and thing caused by the pandemic. And that was not me.
Yeah, that wasn't me either. I had just moved to California, and then like 2 weeks later, we were in lockdown.
Yeah, oh my God.
And so I didn't get to experience my new state.
Yeah.
I'm not complaining much because I do live by the beach.
Yeah, glorious.
But
so nice.
At the same time, I know the 2 miles of my neighborhood and I know almost nowhere
else. Yeah, no, like it was kind of the same for me because we just moved to this new city. It was the winter. So we moved there. We actually did some traveling. We came back and we were like, oh, you know, we don't really know that many people, but we'll meet people in the springtime. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, so for your experience, I mean, I can relate to it through my own because I had this strange anxiety watching all of my peers say, well, I'm stuck at home anyway, so I'm going to write a song every single day.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to start painting or I'm going to do this. My wife started leatherworking. I mean, it was just like everybody was starting all these projects and I've got a recording studio in my backyard and I'm doing nothing with it. I'm just sitting in my house, gaining weight and just sitting. And I can't bring myself to do anything.
Yeah. Yeah,
because it's just too crippling.
Yeah.
And it's such a strange place to be in as a person who's always kind of been able to rely on my creativity to get me out of tough spots. And now here we are. But you had actually even just moved back to the country. So talk to me about Peru.
Yeah, so Peru was... Oh God, where do I start? Peru was...
start at the beginning. Take me all the way back to what made you want to go there and then going there.
So I kind of grew up as much as I could surrounded by the Latin community in Canada. And I really kind of noticed, so I'm going to make like some huge generalizations here, but Canadians tend to have one of two responses to my blindness. Either they studiously avoid the topic to the point where it's just like... awkward because you know they want to talk about it but they don't want to offend me or whatever.
yeah.
And then there's people that try to pretend that they're totally cool with it by like cracking these blind jokes and everything, and I'm cool with that. I like a good blind joke as much as the next person, but they're all kind of, you know, when you've heard them 1,000 times before, it's not that entertaining anymore. So yeah, they tend to kind of have one of these two responses that are both kind of awkward and forced. But with these like Latin people, that people from Latin America that I was always hanging out with, there was none of that. They just treated me like a person. They didn't ask a lot of questions, but they observed and they just kind of intuitively figured things out instead of either studiously avoiding the topic or being like super awkward about it. And, you know, with some Canadians, that's like the only thing they ever want to talk about, which is kind of lame too. It's like, you know, there's a lot more to me than just that. I have, you know, more depth than, so like, let's talk about other things too. So Latin people were really good about that. So yeah, I wanted to move to a country where I would be immersed in that and where I could be different for a different reason. So instead of being the blind girl, I could be the girl from Canada.
Yeah. And so tell me about the whole situation there, because it was really, really fascinating to hear the completely different way of life that you had.
Yeah. Yeah. It was so different. It was just so, so inclusive. It was like, I got there and it was kind of like with the recording studio, like I'd finally come home and found this place where I fit in, where I belonged. And, you know, I felt like more me, I guess, in that year than I ever felt in Canada, just kind of like this bigger, I guess, more, I don't know, defined version of who I was. And yeah, things were very different. You know, the safety aspect of it, it's, you know, things do happen. It's Latin America.
Yeah.
But I don't know, that part of it never really scared me because it felt like I was so, so included there. So yeah, like things would happen, but you know, and we would.
But you also had to learn how to get comfortable with just sort of rolling with things.
Totally.
Because the impression that I got from it was that everything just sort of happens. And it's maybe not the best situation for someone to be in if they require everything to be rigidly on a schedule or...
Yeah, no, no.
Or, yeah, because, I mean, you talked about everything. Like, you know, the situation about... how you were going to make money was sometimes fluid. The situation about, you know, what you were going to eat was fluid.
Yeah, where we lived.
where you lived. All of that was kind of fluid. I mean, and all of those things can be really great on the one hand because it's an adventure. But on the other hand, it's anxiety.
Yeah, for sure.
So how do you balance that?
You know, it was weird because I've always struggled with a lot of anxiety in a country where everything is fairly, you know, rigid in terms of rules, in terms of, you know, laws and what we can and can't do and, you know, job stability, things like that, housing stability. And I am far more anxious here than I ever was in Peru.
Why do you think that is? I mean, was there something about the flexibility of the life there where, I mean, the trade-offs were just worth it?
I think so, yeah. I think the trade-offs were just worth it. And everybody else was kind of going through the same thing. Like, nobody had that much stability. It was just how you lived.
Yeah. I was just talking to somebody the other day about, growing up in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And her remembrance of it was very similar to that. There are certain, I guess, freedoms that you would give up, but so many more that you'd reap from the situation. But that's such a difficult thing for North American people to get their head around.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, because they want everything, you know. And my partner actually really struggled with that. He didn't speak Spanish when we went down, and he really struggled with that aspect of the culture. Like, I remember this one time we went to a wedding and we thought we were going to be late. We were there, I don't know, 10 minutes before, and it was empty. Yeah. And we're like, that's weird. Like, are we in the wrong place? No, I don't think so. People start showing up about an hour and a half after the ceremony was supposed to start. And I think the bride and groom showed up about close to 3 hours after. So it's just, yeah. Like, and nobody said anything. That was just like how it was. Whereas like in North America, no, that wouldn't fly.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. That's really something. I mean, there's something to be said for just relaxing, and just taking the moments as they come and saying, you know, this is what this is. Now I'm here in this. That can be an incredibly difficult thing to do.
That living in the moment. And I think they're probably better at that than us because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Our moments are definitely pre-planned and scheduled and tight. And that's something that I've been struggling with as well, trying to be a little more spontaneous with those things. But even then, sometimes I catch myself trying to schedule that spontaneity. Mm-hmm. And it's like you just, it kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah, exactly. Not so spontaneous if you schedule spontaneity.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, baby steps.
Yeah, totally.
I guess.
Yeah. Got to start somewhere.
So talk to me about your experience with suicidal ideation, because I have some curious spots on that, because I read the book and I think I understand quite a lot about where you're at with it now. Mm-hmm. And maybe even where it came from, but I do have some kind of specific questions that I'm curious about. And one of them being, is this something that is, do you think is situational as far as like, situations brought it on and you've been able to take yourself out of it? Or is it something that you still think about, like as optional?
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely still something I think about. And I think recovery from, you know, whatever it is we're trying to recover from, it's not like this finish line. It's more of like a choice you make every day. So yeah, like I would be lying to say that it doesn't come up, because it does. I think what we kind of learn are hopefully the tools to deal with it, to recognize when it's happening, to kind of head it off before it gets to the point where you can't do anything about it. I think that's what, you know, we're learning to live with it, not really to get better, I guess.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's everything.
Yeah.
The very idea of kind of having this thing that's always there in your back pocket.
Yeah.
It's strange because in some ways for a while there, that actually kept me alive.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean.
That idea that, you know, well, I can kill myself later if it doesn't work
out. Oh, I know. It's like such a comfort, right? Like I think I said in my book, it's like, you know, you wake up on a rainy day and you realize that you don't have to go anywhere. So you just like snuggle back under the blankets. And it's like that kind of feeling of like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's gotta be very disturbing to the people in your life.
Totally.
To explain.
Yeah. Like if you haven't lived it, it makes no sense.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that that's why it's important for us to be able to have these conversations kind of publicly and take that stigma out of it because, I mean, yeah, it is an option, but it's the idea is to kind of see it as, you know, well, I mean, so is skydiving naked off the top of a building. I mean, it's just, you know, yeah, it's technically an option, but it's not likely.
Yes, exactly.
And those are two very different things.
Yeah. So I think it really is just about minimizing the likelihood of taking that option and making it, you know, lesser of an option, not an almost probability in, you know.
Has the cognitive behavioral therapy been good for you?
It has. I think it's, people get frustrated with it, right? Because it's, you know, you do it one day and you're like, and then you suck at it and you're like, well, this doesn't work for me. I'm going to give up. But no, like you got to give yourself more grace than that, more time, because it isn't always going to work out perfectly. And, you know, sometimes you will completely fail at it. But the goal is to just get a little bit better at it at a time. And I think taking these like giant steps is just not realistic. We need to break it down. So yeah, it definitely is helpful. To me, it's more helpful on some days than others because I'm better at it some days than others.
Well, and saying things like better at it, you know, I really like that. It's because I don't think that people think about it like it's something you can learn. Yeah. I feel like I have conversations with a lot of people about this who haven't really struggled with any sort of mental health issues. And they kind of see it as like a Rubik's Cube to be solved.
Yeah.
Like once you've put all the pieces in place, you're done.
Yeah.
You figured it out. Yeah,
if only. And it's like that with the hospital too, because people would, you know, I came out and people were like, well, you're better now. And I'm like, well, I didn't go in to, you know, have surgery on a broken arm. So.
Right. That was something that really brought me back because it's been a long time since my inpatient situation. And hearing the discussion about the nurses stations and the, you know, getting a roommate and all of that stuff. You know, the last time I was in was in the 90s.
Yeah.
And you were just in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a year ago.
Yeah. So I don't know how much has changed, but
nothing from what I can hear. The difference was people had cell phones. I mean, that was the only difference.
Well, a lot of people didn't. They would actually take them away from a lot of people because what would happen is a lot of people would call, you know, their family members or whoever, and the family members wouldn't know where they were. And they would, you know, be saying all these delusional things, but the family members didn't realize they were in the hospital. So, you know, it can be pretty scary to get a call from somebody who says, you know, everyone's after me, they're trying to kill me. But what's really going on is they're actually in the psych ward.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you too about your particular situation there, because there were a lot of things that you said that I completely related to, but there was something in there that I had a real curiosity about, and it was this idea that you were pretty well open to the idea that there was work that you were there to do, that it wasn't necessarily you were there for them to do work on
you.
And is that something that is maybe unique to your situation, or do you find that the conversations around mental health in your community and, you know, even in Canada, like, do you find that those conversations are very different?
I think a lot of people have the attitude, well, even, you know, a lot of the people there have the attitude that, you know, they're just going to sit back, relax, and somebody else is going to fix it. And, you know, those are the people that don't get better, because you have to do the work yourself. Nobody can do it for you.
Yeah, but where did you first get that awareness? Was that something that was thrust upon you in the moment and you recognized it? Or was that something that had been kind of always there for you?
I think maybe because I've been in therapy since such a young age. It's kind of, you know, and I did study psychology in university. So maybe it's kind of, you know, that background of having been through the therapeutic process so many times and having studied it, just realizing, yeah, there's no magic bullet. There's no, you know, psychologist in the world that's good enough to just fix you if you don't put in the work.
Yeah. Absolutely not, because it requires you to make changes.
Yes.
I mean, the best psychologist in the world is only going to know their training. They're not necessarily going to know what's in your mind, especially if you're not being honest.
Yeah.
Or completely honest.
Yeah, that's
another
thing, too.
There's a lot of things that you've got to do.
Yeah.
So, but being honest about those things and even being completely open and vulnerable like that, What were the mental health conversations that you had had growing up?
Like in terms of like with family and community?
What was your perception about conversations around mental health issues? Like people, like the very concept of someone being depressed and needing assistance.
Yeah, I think, well, I hope it's getting better. I don't know. But like for me as a kid growing up in the 90s, it wasn't really talked about. You know, I remember in junior high kind of getting this list of like, oh, you know, somebody might be suicidal if A, B, C, D. And it was kind of like this checklist thing. And that was really the only conversation we ever had about it. And I lost somebody to suicide when I was 12. And even then it was like this big secret. Like I found out about it on my own because none of the adults wanted to talk about it with us. So then I was kind of left to process that on my own, which probably wasn't a good thing, because then I started thinking, well, like maybe that is an option. I can kind of see why she did it.
Yeah. You know, it sort of reminds me of the old just say no to drugs.
Yeah, how well does that work?
Exactly. I mean, once you just, I kind of understand it. It is a knee-jerk reaction. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where people can say things like, I'm worried about you and what you're doing is scaring me. And so I'm just going to say, well, just knock it off.
Yeah. It's that fear response that kind of turns to almost anger.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think suicide's the same thing. You know, you tell somebody I'm not doing well, and you know their first reaction. So you just stop telling people because their first reaction is, well, you better not do that because that would be the most selfish thing you could do. It's like, okay, I don't need to feel worse. Believe me, I tell myself these things enough. You don't have to do it for me.
Yeah. You mentioned something in the book that I saw some parallels too, because not to dwell on things too much, but I guess, I mean, that's part of why we're here, I suppose.
Totally.
But you got hit with a real triple whammy in a lot of ways, because you're a woman. Mm-hmm. You have depression, mm-hmm. And you're blind.
Yeah.
And there are ways in which all three of those things have worked against you in certain situations, and situations that a lot of other people would not ever find themselves in. And I do want to get to that, but there was something that I think a lot of people don't talk about this enough, and you did talk about it in your book, and I thought it was really amazing because it is something I don't hear very much. And it's this idea that whether you like it or not, and whether you're comfortable with yourself or not, there are times when the things that you're dealing with are a burden on other people, mm-hmm. whether you like it or not. And you can't mask over the reality of that. You talked about going to an amusement park with friends and how it slowed you down.
You slowed them down.
Because
of me.
There's a lot of similarities to mental health issues there too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where there are times when you absolutely can be a like a burden on other people. And that doesn't mean that that's not okay. I mean, that's part of the human contract. But I think we have to start changing the dialogue around what that means and really start engaging people's empathy in those situations instead of expecting. We have to change things, ultimately, is what I'm getting at. But this, tell me a little bit about how you would reconcile those feelings. And do you think that, has any of that ever been a factor as far as how you see yourself?
Yeah, definitely. Like for the blindness part of it, I think, well, and the mental health, like it all just kind of ties into this feeling of being a burden and, you know, people will be sad if I'm not here initially, but in the long run, it's going to be better for them. So that's kind of how I justified, you know, people have this knee jerk reaction of like, oh, it's selfish. But to me, it was kind of this strange act of altruism, I guess. Like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to leave for you because you won't leave me and I'm being a burden to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was there ever a time when you were younger, because you were born with blindness, was there ever times when you were younger, as you were growing up, that it would it would make you feel like you wish that you hadn't been, or, you know, the temper tantrums that you have when you're a child about something that you cannot change about yourself.
Yeah, totally. I think, well, even with school, you know, like I would go to my new high school, you know, last year of junior high for orientation and stuff. And all I would ever hear is, you know, oh, there's not enough money for that. So then my mom would have to, you know, fundraise on her own and do, you know, she was working, she was a single parent, she was going to school, and she had this extra responsibility of, you know, fundraising and advocating so that I could have my equivalent of a pencil and paper.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's such a funny thing. I'm a parent myself now, and I've gone through some things with my kids, and that's their story. So I'm always very careful about only telling my part of it. But there have been some struggles and some situations that they've gone through that required some additional support, some additional effort. And it was one of those things that I just kind of looked at as, all right, that's what it is. That's the reality. So I'm just going to handle it. And it's funny in a way that I was able to engage that part of myself to recognize, that it's just one more thing.
Yeah.
It's just another thing. And yet I can't recognize that in myself.
Yeah, it's so true. Yeah, absolutely. Like, we're all a burden, I think, in quote unquote, in different ways.
Yeah.
But we excuse it in other people and we don't ever let ourselves off the hook for it.
Yeah, but it is a conversation. It's a thing that can be difficult to explain. This idea of, we like to overreact to things and tell people, "Oh, you're not a burden. You're not a problem. What you're doing is not a problem." When I think that there are times when it might be necessary to say, "No, this is a problem, but I'm here for you mm-hmm. in it."
Yeah, absolutely.
Or this is hard today.
Yeah.
And you can have that moment in solidarity.
Yeah.
Like, were there ever moments that you had with your mom where it shined through and you were able to actually talk about it?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there were times probably more when I was younger. And, you know, the emotions are closer to the surface. You don't really hold your cards so close, right? Where, you know, yeah. I would come home from school and such had happened on the playground, or somebody stole this from me, or, you know, they like to steal my cane, things like that, and then not give it back to me for the rest of the day to see how I would do it. So, like, stuff like that. And I would come home and I would just be like, you know, I don't want to do this. And I think for her, yeah, I think, you know, there were days she probably felt the same way, but she was just trying to be a support for me. But I think I realized that it was hurting her. So, you know, less and less, I would just kind of held it, kept my cards close, kept it to myself.
Well, and I'm sure that you don't begrudge her anything in that regard either. I mean, yeah, because all of that is difficult, but that's kind of the thing I'm talking about. It's like this idea that people should be able to have conversations with each other where they're able to address that reality rather than shrink from it. Because the idea that, you know, you would see that she's struggling with something like this and that, you know, you would feel like you've got to make yourself smaller and more manageable.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, all kids do. Mm-hmm. Everybody does, especially when they feel like, you know, I'm being a problem, you know, and then looking at the situation as the problem, not yourself.
Yes.
It's a difficult thing to separate yourself from.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. And more when it's you and not so much when it's other people.
Yeah. Because when it's other people, it's very easy to pontificate on those things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because you get to go home.
Yeah.
I mean, you get to go live in your own life and, you know, not have to deal with it. I mean, there's people starving in other corners of the world right now. And I can try to empathize with that all I want, but I can also go in my house and eat.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We're not living with it. And even for me, to a certain extent, you know, on days when I was feeling really sorry for myself and I'd talk to people and they'd be like, "Oh, I know, like, yeah, it's hard." And I'd be like, "No, you don't know, because, yeah, you're with me sometimes and it's awkward for you because people are staring at us or whatever. You get to walk out of the house sometimes and not get that. I never get to walk out of the house and not get that."
Yeah. Yeah, man. That, you know, and I told you I was going to jump around a lot because, man, just finishing that book, I'm a little all over the place. And, you know, you're saying things that remind me of other things. And so it's going to seem a little like tonal whiplash. But tell me about driving a car.
What time?
Every time. I mean, just tell me all about that, because that was a moment of particular, it sounds like such, talk about managing your cool in a situation like that, that your poor guy, yeah, like just tell me about that. Tell me what is that like?
I really like driving, and I think it's partly because it's something I'm not supposed to do and partly because it horrifies people and I find that funny.
Yes. Right.
But yeah, it's it's fun. It's, you know, it's enjoyable to get to move myself to someplace else, not like by the power of my own 2 feet. So I really like that. Mm-hmm. Other people don't like it as much, but yeah, Jordan, my partner, he's always been really good about that. Like our first date, I don't even remember how it came up, but we just ended up on this like quiet street. It was probably 2-3 a.m. or something like that. We're lucky I didn't get pulled over for drunk driving or something, but
yeah.
But yeah, so I drove his car and he was super cool about it. And honestly, like most of my friends are, I've driven a lot of their cars and most of them think it's kind of funny. And, you know, I haven't crashed them yet. So I don't know. I guess if you want to hang with me, you got to be cool with me driving your car. No, not quite, but just like, you know, stuff like that. Like it's, you know, you could get awkward about it. Like, oh, well, you know, there was another time that I didn't like Jordan's car. So I was like, you know what? No, I'm going to buy my own car that I actually like. And people got so uncomfortable about it because I'd be like, oh yeah, I just bought this new car. And well, new to me, it was actually super old, but it was this really old, cool convertible. And I'd be like telling people about it and they'd be like, but you can't drive. And I'm like, really?
The fuck I can't.
Like, you don't have your driver's license. You don't think I thought about that? Like, oh my God, thank God you told me because otherwise I wouldn't. Wow.
Because you can, I mean, you can see light.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's just very different than the way that people always have this thing where they assume that the way that they're doing it is the only way to do it.
Yeah.
And navigating the world without full sight perception is a complete impossibility for people who haven't had to do it. You know, like you said, people would say to you, I would kill myself if I couldn't see.
Which is, you know, a very weird backhanded compliment, but it's really terrible. Like there's no good reason to say that to anybody ever.
I mean, you could just say to them, you know, why wait?
That's actually really funny that you came up with that because that was totally like my response and I like that I would think about. And I almost wrote that in the book and I was like, no, I can't. Yeah, that's going too far.
That's too dark.
But yeah, that's always what I think. Well, what are you waiting for?
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to wait for that. Exactly.
Hurry up. I'll give you some tips.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all of this, even the fact that you're a person who gets behind the wheel and decides to drive once in a while, that is... I mean, that's the perfect culmination of the kind of person that you are, especially, you know, this agreement that you've made that you're willing to trade safety for life.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is kind of Peru, I guess, too.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. I mean, if you look at it, the things that you've chosen to do, the situations that you put yourself in, it's like, yeah, there may be some harm here, but I'm not gonna not do something because of maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I could live in a bubble, but what kind of life is that? Like, I'd rather run that risk and enjoy life than sit in my house in this bubble because maybe.
Yeah. Now see that right there, that is the very definition of bravery. And bravery is a thing that is kind of tough to access. It's a thing that I think that people don't often associate with someone who's had suicidal feelings.
Yeah.
But I think that those two things are kind of intertwined in a lot of ways because it's sort of the way the mind is able to expand beyond what would be the rigid confines of your upbringing and your teaching and your social conditioning.
Yeah.
It's being able to see things outside of that and go, no, I think I see some other things. And that can be to your detriment.
Yes.
But it can also be used as a positive and manifest itself in bravery and being able to go out and do things and be places. Yeah. I mean, it, just the very idea of getting on a stage and playing music in front of people, that's terrifying to some people,
yeah.
But it's completely freeing for others.
Yeah, that freaks a lot of people out. They're like, how do you do it? And it's like, well, you just do. I don't know.
So talk to me a little bit about performing, because this pandemic has been really rough for all of us who like to, you know, torture ourselves by getting up in front of people. Yeah. Not having that creative outlet, where are you at with it now? Are things starting to open up a little bit? Have you played any since things have started to open up a little? Because things are a little more restrictive still.
Yes, they are. Yeah. So things are opening up. There are like small venues that are allowed to have live music. I haven't actually played live since the pandemic because I've kind of been, well, the book came out and then I've been writing songs and actually working on a recording. So I'll, you know, think about the playing live part later. But COVID, in a way, for me, was actually kind of a blessing in that way, because I, you know, was already really struggling before COVID. And the more I struggled, the less I wanted to play live. So I remember, like, there was this one show I was doing a couple months before COVID really started, and it was freezing cold. It was a festival. It was, you know, nobody was paying attention. Nobody gave a shit whether I was there or not. Yeah. And I didn't give a shit whether I was there or not. And I was just really going through the motions, you know, running on autopilot, just playing these songs on autopilot. And then I kind of went to myself, you don't have to do this. And it was such a relief. And so I think COVID was kind of like this necessary break that I needed, because, I mean, the industry has changed so much. And even since I started, like, you know, probably not in a good way. So I kind of had to get my head around that. And I think I couldn't while I was playing live. And I think I've more made peace with what music looks like now. But at the time, I was really kind of still living in the past, where, you know, even live shows now, like, they've changed so much. And there's this, you know, nobody buys merch really anymore. So there's that, you know, not only that revenue stream is gone, but that connection is almost gone, you know, where you're not really meeting people at the merch table anymore and stuff like that. So it's kind of like, why am I doing this? I could do this at home in my pajamas for myself. So yeah, I think it's been a big adjustment for me. So I think having that time to really reflect on it during COVID, when nobody was performing, was actually a positive for me. And I think I can go back into it with a little bit more acceptance of how the industry is right now, and not necessarily how I want it to be, or living in the past how it was.
I cannot wait to hear what you've got coming. As we're winding down here, I want to do something, and let me know if you're cool with this, because here we are in this situation where we're putting ourselves out there completely, mm-hmm. talking about the struggles that we've got and things like that, with the idea that it's going to help some people. And I wanted to know if you could tell me just a couple of the biggest things you wish people would stop doing when they notice you're blind.
Oh, there's so many. I just don't be weird. Like, I think that's the biggest. People just, I don't know. Like, if you wouldn't want to, you know, to be asked something by a complete stranger in the grocery store or on the bus, just don't do it, because we don't want to be asked either. And just, you know, we're just people, you know. Some of us are nice, some of us are assholes. So, you know, it runs the gamut of everything. And I think people either view us as like these perfect, inspirational people who don't do anything wrong, which is like a lot of pressure to be under when you're, like, you leave your house and it feels like you're always on, which is really unfortunate. Yeah. And I just wish people could see that we're just people and we have our bad days and we can be assholes and all the rest. Like, we're just people. I think I really liked, like, the movie Ray, like, about Ray Charles. I watched it and I was like, yeah, because it actually showed him, like, doing bad things. And it was, like, so refreshing because usually Hollywood's, impression, I guess, or depiction of us is, like, these perfect people doing perfect things, or we're completely useless. It's like one or the other. You're either climbing Mount Everest or you're sitting at home alone in the basement listening to Stevie Wonder records on repeat. So, like, yeah, there is a middle ground. And I guess, yeah, just, we don't want your pity. We just want your acceptance.
Well, I could talk to you forever. This has been absolutely amazing. Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you so much for giving me the chance.
And there you have it. The amazing Heather Hutchison. I was right about that conversation, wasn't I? One of the greatest. Just amazing. If you want to get some more Heather in your life, and I know that you do, go pick up the book Holding On by Letting Go, a memoir. You can find it in audio formats as well as physical copies. It's at all the places you get that stuff. And if you want some music, Where the Ocean Meets the Sand is out now. It is her most recent album until the next one comes out. And if you want to know when that's going to be, stay in touch at heather-hutchison.com, where you can find out all the news for what's happening with her. I'm Chris Parker Howard. I'm on all the social media, Coffee Over Suicide. You can find me all over the place. And until next week, don't kill yourselves out there.